That was part of my conversation with Morgan Godvin. She's a writer, editor, drug policy expert, and member of the Measure 110 Oversight and Accountability Council. Find her on the web at morgangodvin.com. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's Audio Port Service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline on the web at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. You'll also find a link there to subscribe to the Prison Pipeline podcast. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Please give its page a like and share it with friends. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long. Just a soul's intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Hello, my name is TK Kapurai and I'm an immigrant from Zimbabwe. I'm the host of The Global Cell, which airs live in the air room the first Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. I host immigrants and refugees from various global spots. I like to bring out their lived experiences so the world can know something about them. I like to bring a lot through my guests so we may have diverse experiences, cultures, foods, music, interests, and anything on the platform. We can share and learn a lot through their live instructions. Let's do this together, not only for a better platform for our community, but a better community for our platform. Again, tune in for my show, The Global Cell, live in the air room, the first Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and also available on the web at kboo.fm.
Michael here. I'm with the Tin Can Phone Podcast, a radio show where you can hear about the influence incarceration has straight from the source. We tell you the story from the inside out, so make sure to check us out on KBOO Community Radio every first Tuesday at 10 a.m.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroots News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on, let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Welcome to another edition of LTAR Let's Talk About Race. No Black History Month. Revisiting, reading, writing, and book burning. I'm the news director, Althea Billings. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis made the decision to dilute American history by placing conservatives in positions of educational decision-making and challenging any information that promotes intersectionality. That's the bridge where all ages and nationalities can see we can build towards a common purpose while addressing historical wrongs. Reverend Cecil?
Well, I think the power structure in America recognized that if people and communities recognized the way in which they are all oppressed by the power structure, and if we were able to hear one another's stories, recognize our common struggles, and find ways in which we can work together, that power structure, that thing which has enabled this machine to continue for all these many centuries, will begin to collapse. So this insistence to not allow communities to recognize their commonalities, to be able to work together, to recognize that they are all interconnected, that we are all interconnected, that, as others have said, that when one community is oppressed, we all are oppressed, and to recognize that our enemies are not those who are struggling with us for the pieces of crumbs, but recognize that there is a power structure which deny all of us the ability to live into our full humanity. When we have the ability to recognize our commonality, those in power, the power structure itself is threatened and will continue to do everything it can do and has done. If we just take a casual look of American history and the way in which the power structure has encouraged the division of people who have been oppressed from working together. So throughout the history, poor people, people who are outside the power system, have often been pitted against one another rather than being able to recognize their commonality. And the amazing thing for me is to recognize that in spite of all that effort to separate peoples and communities, that many times people resist that argument and see that we are connected with one another and find ways to work together. So I think when there is that continued oppression and work to divide communities, that we must continue to work as hard to find ways in which people can hear one another and find ways to work together.
DeSantis's crusade on diversity and race comes in a state colonized by the Spanish, where there's intersections of Black, Latino, and Indigenous culture and history. But DeSantis claims African-American AP history is indoctrination. This claim is a part of the big backlash against racial understanding.
I think it's important to reflect on the genesis of what is now known as Black History Month, and that it wasn't something that was created by the powers that be. It wasn't a part of the curriculum in school. It was the steady effort of African Americans through the 19th century and leading up to the 20th century, where Carter G. Woodson and others press for the remembrance and celebration of Black history, because it was not taught at all. In the early 1920s, when Carter G. Woodson's and others in Black communities encouraged parents and churches and schools to recognize and teach the contribution of descendants of Africa in the America landscape and history, it was something that they were able to impart on a larger society. So first of all, I think it's important to recognize that had it not been for the advocacy of people who had been marginalized, nothing of significance would have been included in the curriculum of schools throughout the nations. Having said that, I think it's important to recall that there has always been a resistance to the contribution of marginalized people in the Declaration and in the ability to tell the story of this American experience. Whether it is the stories of Black people or the study of Indigenous people or the study of women, anything that has pushed against the predominant theme that has been taught throughout the history of the American Republic has encountered resistance. The latest example, I think we realize from politicians, not only from the governor of Florida, but throughout the nations, is an ongoing push to negate the contribution of marginalized people. And it just tells me that we must continue to have our stories told wherever and however we can. In spite of the resistance, it's nothing new, but we must continue to push forward to work to create a more inclusive and more accurate, more truthful narrative of the development, history, and future of this country.
Mary Lee?
I'm going to say some words. I think it's despicable. I think it's cowardly. I think history will not look at these people in any other manner other than with derision and judgment. The edits of what got taken out of those AP courses are not accidental. They are part of this ongoing onslaught against anything that might disagree with a white supremacy culture understanding of who they are and what their entitlement is for how they are treated in our society. And by the way, how we continue to treat African-American, women, queer, anyone else who's not white and male or white adjacent white women, right? White male adjacent white women. I also want to say, while deeply, deeply disappointing and enraging, I think we can't think about this in an exceptionalism way. We have to understand that here in Portland, Oregon, we had a series of very deeply researched and long time work called the Baseline Essays that were meant to provide guidance to educators in Portland Public Schools related to the teaching of African American, Asian American, Latine, and Native American history, both in nationally and in the local area. And those baseline essays were also very challenged. They're not actually really implemented in the ways in which the community had hoped to implement them. So I want to contextualize this with, it's too easy to think about Mr. DeSantis as, you know, some kind of an exceptionally bad person doing exceptionally bad things. He is a bad person doing bad things. And we are also here locally part and parcel of that that movement. And that understanding that somehow to our rhetoric to the contrary, we don't actually care that much about children. We don't care about educating them to be citizens of the world. We don't care about equipping them with the skill sets that will help them succeed in a changing world, in a diverse world, in a world where people of color are the majority. And we're doing that at our danger. A danger to ourselves, a danger to democracy, and a danger to our very ability to live and work and play and be with each other. So, yeah, despicable. The AP folks who cowed to this, cowardly, cowardly, cowardly. And we got to understand that we all are a part of it too.
Professor Johnson?
This is just astonishing to me. I don't know when Governor DeSantis became an expert on education, but somehow it happened recently. And it's the hypocrisy of it is, I think, my first reaction, because he's talking about wokeness and cancel culture. To me, this is cancel culture, when you are denying people the choice to take AP classes and to take AP classes on these subjects that are important contemporary subjects, which we've made a lot of progress on, And this just seems like he's turned the car around and wants us to go backwards. I'm pretty appalled. I'm appalled that this was even considered and that this change was made. And I really would like to see politics stay out of education and that we focus more on what kind of citizens do we want to produce. Do we want them to be culturally aware? Do we want them to have some kind of understanding? And this is just the opposite of, to me, creating an informed citizen, which I think should be part of the goal of education.
My thoughts on the matter, the first thing when I think of AP, I took AP classes in high school. I went to public high school in a very, very liberal area. And AP US history was the first time that I started to get a taste of actual American history. Of course, it had been taught in one way or another in my schooling up until that point, but that was when I first started to be able to understand the actually complicated and complex history of the United States that informs literally everything that is going on. And one, not everybody gets that opportunity, but for me, AP, the College Board, had a decent reputation in that regard. And even in the draft that was released, I believe NBC News published their initial draft, that it seemed to fulfill on a lot of these things of what would a advanced placement African American studies class really look like? What would we really want people to understand and know? And my hypothesis is that this revision, this cowing to conservatives, will still be dismissed out of hand as critical race theory. I believe that that will be the case. I believe that nothing will be accomplished by censoring in this way, because critical race theory, whatever they're saying that is, that's not what it is. We can't chase ourselves in circles about it anymore. I don't believe that this will actually result in Florida high schoolers being able to learn what's left of this curriculum. I don't think that these changes will have made a difference. I think that it's important to point out that the College Board produces AP curriculum on French language and culture, German language and culture, Japanese language and culture. And we're talking about cultures that are not native to the United States. And so that this is so controversial, I think it's important to notice that. And also that the College Board and AP classes represent an opportunity to obtain college credit as a high schooler. And that AP classes are desirable for students because of that reason. And so to have the opportunity to get a credit in a African American studies class in high school, that also has economic implications in terms of how quickly can you complete high school or how quickly can you complete college. I think that all of those things kind of overlap. I think that what's the point in censoring the truth? The truth is still going to be out there. People are still going to be curious and interested in it. And I think that this watered down version is bad for academic integrity. I can't quite conjure the good words that Mary had there, but it is despicable. It's not right. And I mean that their original draft was published, I think makes that all the more stark, that this wasn't their initial plan. Their initial plan wasn't to include or disinclude all of these things. And one of the most powerful things taking a history class, especially as a high schooler, is like, why do we stop in the 50s? Why do I not get to know what Ronald Reagan did? Maybe we'll talk about, hey, 9/11, that was bad. You guys were alive for that. Wasn't that, you don't remember it, but you were alive. History is happening now. It's happening all around us. And kids today have seen that more than anybody. The pandemic, this incoming recession, the Black Lives Matter movement, those are major moments in history. And so to deny that any of that is happening and to water it down is awful.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning, progressive, intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
I participate and have continued to participate in Let's Talk About Race simply because I benefit. And I believe that all action that any of us take must be rooted in revolutionary loving self-interest. If I'm not in the game, I shouldn't be on the playing field. I get back so much more than I give. I get to learn and hear new ideas and be challenged and inspired. And I need these experiences to grow and to gain inspiration and the resources that I need internally to be able to continue my work. So first and foremost, I benefit and I am eternally grateful to be in relationship and community with this circle of amazing people that come together monthly to do our work. I also believe that this work is critical to those who are listening to these sessions. And I'm hoping that they are having similar experiences to ours, that they're learning something new, that they're being confronted with perhaps something they haven't thought about enough, that they are being inspired and provoked in the best ways to challenge themselves and others in their lives. The voices of my colleagues are critical to creating the world in which we all want to live. And as we all know, to be seen and to see is one of the most powerful acts of resistance that we can offer ourselves and each other. And Let's Talk About Race is one of the ways that I get the privilege of being able to participate in these kinds of revolutionary acts. And thus, even though it sometimes is a challenge to show up every time with a new topic and do the homework and do the reading, I am motivated. I am deeply motivated. And I hope that the efforts that we all put in to be here in circle and in community have that ripple effect where you drop the stone in the water and you just don't know where the idea and the impact of that conversation is going to land. I believe it lands on the side of justice, and I believe it lands on the side of action, and that's why I'm in.
America is undergoing another backlash to the increasing awareness of racial justice following the murder of George Floyd as school leaders try to confront long-standing inequalities. Some public schools are trying to address this issue with diversity, equity, and inclusion. However, white conservatives are creating a false flag and blocking this effort by challenging this awareness with educational gag orders. And these educational gag orders are pulling the books off shelves to stop teachers from teaching any subject that will make white children feel bad. Thus, reading, writing, and book burning.
I'm sure we've got hundreds of people out there that would like to see those books before we burn them.
Books deemed to be sowing division in the classroom by Republican-controlled boards are being reviewed by authorities. Some are being removed from the shelves.
I don't know that any advocate who's been working on tracking or paying attention to the freedom to read can recall a time when the same book was removed or targeted with such vitriol and haste in so many places all over the country at once. And then the involvement of politicians, state legislatures, governors, this is categorically different. This is next level.
We're gonna embrace our parents, not ignore them.
The issue was key to the Republicans' retaking of the governorship of Virginia for the first time in 11 years, even after Donald Trump's popularity had slumped there last November. Ibram X. Kendi's book, Stamped, was the second most targeted book for banning in the U.S. in 2020, according to the American Library Association. He traces the current mood of censorship to a backlash against the Black Lives Matter protests of 2020.
You had more people, particularly more white Americans, seeking to understand the history and really the presence of, you know, of racism, the history of all the different groups that have formulated this country. Then you had this bitter attack to prevent people from learning their history, from understanding their history, from seeking to understand how it was that George Floyd was murdered in such a brutal way.
But the range of books being targeted go way beyond those analyzing race in U.S. society.
The selection suggests hostility to any consideration of gender, sexual identity, reproductive rights, or in this case, just a simple acknowledgement that three African-American women were crucial to NASA in the 60s.
In fact, many of the lists circulating of objectionable books have not originated locally from concerned parents, but have been compiled by groups funded by national Republican Party donors.
It's pretty clear that one side of the political spectrum believes is a winning political issue.
Is the attack on education about parental concern that children not be made uncomfortable or feel guilty when race is talked about at school, or is it something more nefarious?
I think it is something more nefarious, as you asked. John Legend tweeted recently, "Aren't Black parents parents also? Let our history be taught." And this is part of a long history, obliterate or ignore the history of the American people, that is different from the popular, and I would say not accurate, portrayal of the establishment of the American Republic. It is crucial for concerned people to stand up and say that all history is important, and that we need to hear the voices and the stories. And if we are uncomfortable, so let it be. I think we should ask, what about the comfort level of Indigenous people when you forget about their history? What about how uncomfortable Chinese Americans, descendants of people who were not welcome, how do they feel? What about the uncomfortableness of Latino and Latina citizens who are ignored in much of our history? I think it is part of an ongoing effort not only to restrict the accurate portrayal and teaching of history, but a way in which to continue to control the American electorate and to have a way in which power remains in the hands of a few.
Mary Lee, what are your thoughts?
There's part of me that almost wants to laugh at this idea of children cannot be made to feel uncomfortable, guilty. Let's be absolutely clear. Our children, as Reverend Prescott says, have always been absolutely made to feel uncomfortable, guilty, and worse in the public education system. And there was no problem with that. In fact, it was understood that that was the way it was. There was a righteousness about this. And for now, a small number of predominantly white families and parents to somehow be overly concerned about the uncomfortable nature, the guilty nature that their children might potentially be exposed to by the telling of truth about our history, is laughable in many ways if it wasn't so dangerous and horrific. I think this is absolutely connected to many other repressive strategies. And I think it drives back to the fear of the mythological end of the world as we know it, AKA 2044, 2045, when the minority majority will be the case in the US. I think a lot of the repression and the actions of the right have been driven by the fear of this, you know, future horror that is coming to eat up our country and eat up ourselves. There's a couple of things that are, again, erroneous about it. I think the inability for people to actually tell the truth about things is shocking, right? We've had a lot of conversations about this. We are already minority majority in many places around the country. Particularly, the first place we're going to see and understand this is with our children and our schools. Our population, as you go younger, is getting more brown, more people of color, more Black, more Indigenous, and that means that things need to and should have been and are changing. those who have been in power, those who have accepted power as their entitled right, are understandably nervous and afraid. The danger is where they decide that they have to take some action. The focus under the guise of parental control, right? We're simply wanting to make parents be able to make decisions for their children is clear and strategic. You know, in many schools and districts where children of color are the majority in the school, the teachers are predominantly white and the agitators are predominantly white parents. And they are the ones that districts and school boards are being pandered to. You also have to tie in the very clear strategy that I think was practiced. It died down a little bit and it's come right back up to the forefront of the stage by the right and the religious right working to get themselves elected to these quote unquote lower elected positions, particularly school boards, utility districts, you know, in order to try to start influencing from a very grassroots bottom up place of becoming elected and thus being able to make the policies that we are going to have to deal with now and in the future. And there are many people who have talked about this as part of a strategy where we're going to look at restricting voting rights to manipulate power and disenfranchise whole buckets of our community, whole pieces of our community today. And we're going to indoctrinate and continue to teach self-hatred and a supremacy culture of white people and white supremacy culture to our own children that will infect them and their selves coming into the future.
I want to make sure that I'm being clear about which books we're referencing, because there are some books that are within the American canon that have, at the very least, problematic and very oftentimes racist depictions of folks throughout American history that may not be as worthwhile for studying. So I think there's that camp, and there's the other camp that is more modern works or works that are informative towards a racial reckoning, towards greater compassion, towards the kind of values that children should be learning that are also being censored because of this fear that it touches race. And with this idea that children shouldn't be made uncomfortable or feel guilty at school, I think that is misplaced as a framing device, 100%, because I've been in a math class where I wanted to cry because I missed a day and I didn't understand what was going on. Should that be banned? There were units in my chemistry class that everybody in class suffered through. It's difficult stuff to learn. Should we not be learning that? It's that reflexive reaction that gets people riled up.
We haven't heard from you on this topic. Why don't we turn it over to Nia?
Thank you, Professor Johnson. As I was researching this question, and Mary Lee, what you said is terrifying, that there's some playbook that people are using that's definitely nefarious to flood these local legislatures and school board meetings. I was thinking about it, you know, very recently we did a backlash show for Let's Talk About Race. And I was thinking about the anti-wokeness and vilifying critical race theory, even when they don't know what it means exactly, but just taking that term and vilifying it is another example of the backlash post so-called racial reconciliation after the death, the murder of George Floyd, that most people, I actually remember at that time, wanted to know, hey, what can I do? I might actually be interested in this, and realized that it was gonna take a skin in the game, that it was gonna take some personal work. But really all they wanted to do is call themselves anti-racist at the end of the day. I'm not contributing to the problem. I'm not killing Black people. You know, I'm an anti-racist. And to avoid any personal discomfort, to truly attack racial reconciliation that would come from that, there's a new narrative that the anti-CRT GOP, that they're preserving the best of this country by protecting the children from these bad ideas that might give their children personal comfort. So in addition to sort of protecting parents, protecting themselves for not really having to have a true reconciliation about race, they're like, oh, this is bad for me. I don't want little Timmy to have to go through this either and start feeling bad about himself. And I think what's interesting is what I see from progressives and even people of color, they're going after this by saying, well, you don't really know what CRT is. Let's really talk about what it is. Let's change the narrative on that, because it doesn't matter what it means. It's this underlying resistance. That's what this is really all about. And just like Mary Lee said, the 2044, the Browning of America, that really what this resistance is coming from is worries about culpability, escaping accusations of being racist, and avoiding economic displacement. But being awake and aware of how our systems of power operate creates enemies. It creates enemies at work. It creates enemies politically, amongst neighbors, in the church that I've seen firsthand, and obviously in our educational system, because it indicts the status quo. And that's really what they want to keep, is the status quo.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning progressive intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
Are we prioritizing white children's feelings over children of color with this kind of legislation?
I would argue that the efforts are to prioritize white parents' feelings over that of students generally, but certainly students of color. There's a school district not too far outside of Portland that banned Black Lives Matter and Pride flags from schools, calling them political symbols. I think the goal of any teacher is to get kids excited about learning and to engage with the material and build critical thinking skills, and that means figuring out how to challenge them within that range where they can reach out and grab it, but it requires them to grow. And if you want kids to not be uncomfortable or guilty in school, you should be advocating for greater resources for schools and teachers so kids don't get left behind, so that they have resources, counselors to help them process their feelings and interactions.
Mary Lee, what are your thoughts on that?
I have to say, I'm not sure that it's prioritizing the feelings of white children, because I don't think that any human being starts out as a child and understands oppression and white supremacy. I think those things are taught. I think this is actually about the adults feeling uncomfortable and the white adults prioritizing their own feelings over clearly what are the reality that their children are experiencing in these classrooms, which are becoming more and more brown. It's, again, part of this strategic approach that I think we must spend a lot of our time and effort understanding. If the right can continue to create confusion and leverage our own discomfort on the progressive side of things for taking space for who we are, we've talked about this before, to be a bold and unapologetic about what we stand for, the use of these terms. Nia, you were just talking about how all of these terms, critical race theory, woke, political correctness, have been taken and turned against and used as a weapon against the progressive movement. And there is something about, you know, continuing to grasp the dying shreds of their white supremacy will not be pulled out of their cold, you know, dead grasp, that flavors all of this conversation and all of this strategy. And I'll tell you what is so insidious about this for me is it's parading children who I would posit in our culture, we talk a lot about protecting and uplifting, and we do very little of it as in reality, but we're parading them out as the, you know, the poor lambs that must be protected. And what instead we are doing is we are teaching hate. We are teaching hate to white children, and we are teaching them to understand their entitlement within a white supremacist society. And worst of all, We are teaching our own children to at least question themselves, be divorced from their history, from their legacy, from their truth that would help them stand against the onslaught of the white supremacy culture. And at the worst, we are making them hate themselves. Because when they are given these lessons, when they are kept from information, when they are told lies that are based in white supremacy, we hear it, they hear it, it goes right into their heads and hearts. And I think there is the basis of some of the conversation we've had about at what point does the progressive community or the left start to question ourselves about our lack of ability to be legitimate and to see ourselves as legitimate and to heal from all of that internalized oppression to build a new perspective and a new way forward. And as long as this kind of behavior continues, our children are being indoctrinated just as their children are being indoctrinated, and we will not see the changed world that we're interested in. So I think it's less about the children, even though we're all about the children in this society. We like to talk about the children, the poor children, and it's about the adults. It's always about the adults.
Cecil, same question to you. What are your thoughts?
I appreciate what Mary had to say about it's all about the adults. First of all, we all recognize that parenting, raising children is a challenging, difficult job. All of us know what it is like to try to create an environment for our children where they are safe, where they are able to meet the challenges they face. And we all want to protect our children. But we also need to recognize that oftentimes we do not have the knowledge or the skills or even the desire to address some things that children may want answers for. And it has been our own experience, and I believe our children's experience, that the teacher is often the one you may go to that you trust. And we should continue to support our teachers. And this is a whole, I don't want to go off and talking about how we fail to pay our teachers or support them enough. But the fact is that teachers are the adults that children trust and depend on. And that when we seek to limit the ability of teachers to talk about things we don't want to talk about. We don't want to talk to our children about sex. We don't want to talk to our children about race. We don't want to talk to our children about how people continue to mistreat and destroy our environment. And I think that we need to continue to find ways in which we allow our teachers to do what they are trained to do, to listen, to care for, and to guide our students.
We have a parent in Nia, so I'd like to hear, Nia, what your thoughts are.
Well, so much about what I remember learning about Black history and what it means to be a Black woman happened at home. I actually don't remember any significant, it's Black History Month, maybe there was some Black History Minutes, but everything I learned at home or through community leaders. And that's how it's always going to be, that there's only so much that they can do at school or learn at school. I think what happens is as a parent, you teach your child, and whether it's love or hate, acceptance, really where it's demonstrated is at school. I think by the time they get to school, maybe it was Mary Lee that said that they've already been sort of wired and groomed to feel a certain way about racism and people that are different from them. And Ava, who's my daughter, who's 9, in the 4th grade, I believe it was like in the 2nd grade, maybe around elections, where my daughter hears me participating and having conversations about Black Lives Matter, about LGBTQ, trans rights and things like that. And so she's in a rural community because her grandparents are Caucasian, and she's in this rural area with chalk drawing rainbow flags and writing Black Lives Matter all over her grandparents' driveway because that's what we teach in our house. But then she went to school and she said, well, one of her friends has a giant Donald Trump, and she goes to a mostly Caucasian suburban school, has a big Donald Trump flag in their front yard and is in the classroom telling her that Donald Trump is going to save America. You know, even at Ava's age, these children are having these conversations, but, you know, it's what they learn at home that sort of comes out at school and stains or paints the way that the children, you know, deal with each other as friends and classmates. I wanted to bring up sort of another issue with what we're talking about and the bigger picture beyond teaching accurate American and world history. What's interesting is all of this is under the guise of individual liberty. One other thing Ava brought home to me that a young man, instead of saying, yes, this is good, no, this is bad, he just said, and I'm guessing he heard it from his dad or his mom, that he's about individual liberty. Under the guise of this individual liberty, you can limit discussions about race and discrimination. And that's actually, I think, the name of some of the bills in Florida, the Individual Liberty Bill. In addition to that, under that umbrella, you can also see their anti-masking and anti-woke sort of propaganda all under the umbrella of this individual liberty.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, internationally awarded Best Audio Podcast and Best Audio Production at the Swedish International Film Festival, Eddie Play International Film Festival in France, Echo Nation Audio and Film Festival in Greater Manchester, England, Bright International Film Festival in London, and at the Fourth Dimension Independent Film Festival in Bali, Indonesia. Let's Talk About Race is an intergenerational roundtable discussion of independent journalists who engage in rigorous conversations and analysis of news coverage regarding the role race plays in politics, government, the economy, education, and health. And now, back to our show.
Is your school board protesting books in your school library designed to educate, expand, and relate to a diverse student body? Do you want to protest critical race theory and you still don't know what? The King of the United States, a vaccine mandate is illegal, and the Confederacy won the Civil War. At Jeff Sessions Library, you have the individual freedom not to hear all that stuff about slavery, oppression, and democracy. At Jeff Sessions Library, there is no mention of slavery, just involuntary immigration. The Civil Rights Movement was a communist plot, and Martin Luther King was a Bible salesman. Women's rights are family values. And at Jeff Sessions Library, there is no educational exposure to the history and culture of those who have a different skin color or life experience. At Jeff Sessions Library, the brutality of slavery is never presented. There is no need to raise awareness or empathy for those outside your life experience. At Jeff Sessions Library, we will present opposing perspectives of the Holocaust. And the messiness and inequalities of America's past will never be addressed. Yes, at Jeff Sessions Library, you can direct your school to turn those library spaces into much-needed coat racks and school storage. And at Jeff Sessions Library, we can turn your existing books into kindling for fires. Because at Jeff Sessions Library, our books have no words on the pages. Therefore, no child will be challenged, transported, or developed. That is a job for the traditional family. where spare the rod, spoil the child. A little whack on the wife is good for her, and keep your women pregnant and in the kitchen. At Jeff Sessions Library, our history is America in the 1950s, just where we're headed now, because backwards is forward at Jeff Sessions Library.
You are listening to Let's Talk About Race, internationally awarded Best Audio Podcast and Best Production at the Swedish International Film Festival, Ediplay International Film Festival in France, Echo Nation Audio and Film Festival in Greater Manchester, England, Bright International Film Festival in London, and at the Fourth Dimension Independent Film Festival in Bali, Indonesia. Let's Talk About Race is an intergenerational roundtable discussion of independent journalists who engage in rigorous conversations and analysis of news coverage regarding the role race plays in politics, government, the economy, education, and health. And now, back to our show.
Listening to the news is experiencing one trauma dump after another. Therefore, at Let's Talk About Race, we created a new segment to inspire. This segment is entitled, Hope is a Thing with Feathers.
The Hope is a Thing with Feathers that I came up with was the moves towards more sustained investment in affordable housing and homeless services. That is something that we're seeing in the Pacific Northwest at a statewide level, a historic investment into those things and mitigating those issues. I think for too long we've seen them run out of control with legislators kind of throwing up their hands or turning to older tactics of shoving it under the rug. Let's allow a skid row to happen or trying to get people out of town. Sustainable solutions are possible. It's a complex issue. It requires funding, and so much of it is progress is stymied by inconsistent funding. So these longer term plans to invest billions of dollars into more affordable housing being built, rezoning is another big aspect, that we're not just going to be beholden to single family homes for forever in American cities. I mean, especially on the West Coast, there's a lot of suburban sprawl and stuff like that. Urban density is a thing that we can strive for in a way that is sustainable and, you know, not an eyesore. That's a lot of what people worry about. So I'm just encouraged to see that in these legislative cycles that states are going through right now, that they're making these big moves, big investments towards making sure that people in the state have housing.
Many people think that hope is looking at the younger generation. I want to look at the older generation. In particular, I ran across a new movement headed by Akaya Winwood and Bill McKibben, and partially inspired by the work that Neil Young and Joni Mitchell did in going after Spotify. And this movement is called the Third Act, and it is encouraging, organizing older people to take up the cause and to participate and advocacy in using their knowledge and our experience over decades of organizing, and saying that it's not quite time for us to sit back, that we have something to contribute.
What gives me hope is that it's Black History Month, and I love hearing stories because there's a lot of content that we see in February that we unfortunately don't see throughout the rest of the year. So I enjoy hearing stories I've never heard of about unsung African American men and women. And I was unfamiliar with the relationship of Nelson Rockefeller and Martin Luther King. I watched an interview with Clarence B. Jones on MSNBC last weekend and was just tickled by this story that when Martin Luther King and hundreds of children were arrested after the Children's March in Birmingham, civil rights organizers wanted to, you know, raise some cash to make bail. And a lot of people were really upset that these children had to even spend 1 minute in jail. So apparently Harry Belafonte and Clarence B. Jones got a call from the Rockefellers that said they would help, and they had $100,000 that Jones actually signed a promissory note inside a big bank vault, which I can't even imagine what that must have been like. Pretty intimidating after hours in a Chase bank. And he personally signed a promissory note in exchange for $100,000 in cash. And what was interesting is he called out that this type of promissory note, he was financially on the line. And the type was, when the creditor says, "I want my money now, you better pay it in person." So the story is that the children were bailed out, and then Jones received a receipt from the Rockefellers that said paid in full. So just a reminder that hope can come from unlikely allies.
It's February, so many teachers and schools are celebrating Black History Month, but there are still many misconceptions and misunderstandings about the past, present, and future of this celebration. So today, I thought we'd go back to the beginning. Hi, this is Mike Hines, and I'm a professor here at the Stanford Graduate School of Education, where my work focuses on the history of America's schools. What we now know as Black History Month had its beginnings as Negro History Week, which was invented by the famed historian, educator, and activist Carter G. Woodson in 1926. Negro History Week was a direct challenge to traditional curricula of the time period, which often degraded and dehumanized Black people. Negro History Week was also inextricably linked to Black calls for social and political equality. More than just a chance to talk about a few notable achievements, Negro History Week was a call to action. Although Negro History Week became one of his most widely known interventions, it was only part of Dr. Woodson's efforts to develop, democratize, and disseminate information on Black history. He also pursued this work through the establishment of the Association for Negro Life and History, its journals, the Journal of Negro History and the Negro History Bulletin, and textbooks, speeches, pamphlets, and materials for every grade level from college down to kindergarten. Now, Woodson didn't do this work alone. Moving from idea to reality took the dedication of thousands of Black teachers, most of them women, who were largely responsible for shaping the celebration through their work in the classroom. It also took the work of entire communities, including churches, fraternities and sororities, libraries and lodges, social clubs, and civic organizations. This reflected Woodson's desire to encourage lay people, not just academics, to preserve and present their own histories. As the movement continued to grow, it outstripped the bounds of a single week, and the word Negro, which was outdated by the 1960s, was replaced by a new generation born and raised in the civil rights struggle. Black History Month emerged in its current form during those decades and is still going strong. So, is this celebration still relevant today? Well, it depends on who you ask. Critics charge that the progress we've made from the 1920s to the 2020s has largely made Black History Month irrelevant. Or that worse, singling out Black history is actually counterproductive to broader efforts at inclusion. Although we may have made progress, however, research from the Southern Poverty Law Center and other sources still shows that we are far from our goal of honoring the multiple voices in our classrooms and challenging dominant narratives. At the same time, new and emerging movements for racial justice call out for historical context, which our schools simply fail to provide. Carter G. Woodson himself was cautiously optimistic that students in the future would no longer need Black History Month if we taught in ways that honored and elevated our students and told their stories all year long. But we're not there yet. So Black History Month will continue to be what it always has been, a celebration, a stinging indictment, and a call to action, all in one.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, Reading, Writing, and Book Burning. Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race,
visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by Grassroot News Northwest.
Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Milton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on. Let's talk about race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things. Talk about things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Mr. and Mrs. Radioland, I am Eldridge Cleaver, the former Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio. I want you to listen to and support KBOO because Portland needs it, you need it, and the world needs it. Ubalagani! Boing, boing.
Hello, dear listeners. Oil for Kisses is a monthly program on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, that highlights the headier and weirder sides of underground metal, post-punk, DIY hardcore, and beyond. Every month features a different theme where we delve into the history of a specific genre topic or musical location, or simply churn out the best, brightest, and ugliest sounds from around the